This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Four men on North Carolina's death row tell their stories in the recently published book Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row. Their stories weave together memories of childhood, the events that led them to prison, and the brutality they face in incarceration. The 30 personal essays remind readers of the humanity of those locked inside the criminal justice system. Tessie Castillo is a journalist, a public speaker, and co-author of Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row. Tessie, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lyle May is another co-author for Crimson Letters. He's a prisoner at Central Prison in Raleigh. Lyle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. You came to this project with some writing experience under your belt. You've contributed your writing to several publications. You've even published a memoir in 2014. How did Tessie approach you about this collaboration?
She initially wrote a letter asking if I would be willing to contribute to the book. I don't think we quite had a title for it yet, but that she was essentially considering creating a collection of essays of our writing. When she asked, I agreed to do it simply because I want that opportunity to put my writing out there for the public, to bridge that gap with the community and help them understand that we are real people in here.
Well, you tell that story, your story, over nine chapters, from growing up in Maine, trying to find meaning in your experience in prison at the other end of those nine chapters. Very personal essays, and they deal with some very hard subjects. You write about being beaten by guards when you were 19, the ever-present shadow of death, obviously, in your situation now. What is the process of writing like for you?
It's work. There's nothing specifically easy about it. To compare it to something, it's a lot like sculpting. It's a lot like digging. It's mining. It's backbreaking. It's mind bending, and it's not all the time satisfying. Cause I always feel that there's more to say. There's an evolving thought process that goes with writing. That even as you complete an essay or an article or a book, there's always more happening. Your opinion changes in some cases, and in other cases, it just strengthens, and you want readers to feel that or understand that. And unfortunately, the thing about writing is that it's a fixed point in time, and there's always the need to recapture that point.
Well, there's even a deeper evolution that brought you to writing. You talk about arriving on death row, and for those first few months there, you were hurting yourself. Your sense of yourself was, it seems, you were lost and in a real funk and despair that could have been, may not have necessarily have led you to writing. Talk about your connection with Earl and how that changed things for you.
Earl really helped ground me in many of the things that my parents had taught me growing up that I had lost touch with. He reminded me that, you know, of course I'm going to hurt, that part of being in prison and on death row is that you're in pain. You need to come to grips with that. And he helped me do that by finding exercise. And it was something simple that could be done repeatedly over and over to a point that it became meditative. And that, you know, kind of helped settle me somewhat. But it wasn't just Earl that helped settle me. It was a return to my Catholic roots. I began attending Catholic Mass, local church, St. Francis of Assisi, sent priests into death row, and that helped me gain a spiritual element to my improvement. But I think most importantly, or as importantly, was access to higher education. I was early on in my incarceration, around 2005, I began gaining access to correspondence courses, first through UNC Chapel Hill, and then later on through Ohio University. And as my understanding about where I am and about how I got here and about all the different elements that are related to the criminal justice system began to coalesce. I really felt that I had something to say. And as time passed and as I grew steadier in my understanding of these things, that desire became overwhelming, and I began writing. First, some short stories for the annual prison contest, and then later the self-published memoir, and then a blog. And then it became this thing where I didn't feel like I was doing enough, that it wasn't enough to have just a blog or to, you know, self-publish a memoir or even to get a few articles published. It was this everyday desire to show people what goes on behind these walls, not just in a system sense in the various policies that impact people in prison, but also the human elements that are so often forgotten and buried behind these walls.
Well, Tessie Castillo, who is the journalist and co-author of Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row, let me ask you, what brought you to this project?
Well, in 2014, I was offered a really unique opportunity to teach a journaling class to men on death row as a volunteer. I taught a class of about 20 students out of the roughly 140 men on death row at the time. And the class gave them an opportunity to reflect on how they got to prison and on how they had grown and what they had learned since they had been there. And being inside the prison, I just saw some really incredible things. I saw what the prison environment, which is very inhumane and designed to punish and designed to break, I saw what it could do to people. And some of the people in my class, they did seem very broken in a lot of ways. They had given up. They were selfish, many of them. But in other men like Lyle, I had seen that they had taken that same suffering and they had turned it into an opportunity to grow. And in those men, I saw levels of wisdom and humility that I've never seen before, not even in people outside of prison. I was so moved by that, that I wrote a letter to the Raleigh News Observer about those observations. And about a week later, I got a very terse letter from the warden of Central Prison telling me that my services were no longer required and my class was canceled. So after that, I started writing to several of the men, including Lyle, and their letters were just so full of understanding about the human condition and these gems, these little nuggets of wisdom. So we decided to put together the book, and it turned into Crimson Letters.
Well, Lyle mentioned it, and you just referred to it here, this sense of a deep humanity that others who think about death row and don't have the intimate experience that you do, having worked with people on death row and Lyle being on death row, may miss about the experience. Talk more about what you found and what you hope, you know, people derive from this sense of humanity that I don't think many of us on the outside would perceive for death row.
The one thing that people have in prison is time. And although not all of them have used it wisely, many of them take that time and they've used it to reflect on themselves, on their past, and on what they want for the future. And that's something that those of us on the outside who are constantly busy, a lot of us have never really done. We don't take that time to reflect. And so there's just a level of wisdom and understanding of the human experience that is unique, I think, to the prison environment and to some people who've spent a lot of time in prison. And I think those of us on the outside would really benefit from listening to and learning from people in prison who've gone through that.
Lyle?
I think it's important to remember that a lot of the times when you think of people in prison, it's from a certain perspective. What our writing in Crimson Letters provides is a challenge to that narrative, this idea that you can throw people away in a box and not think of them anymore. Crimson Letters and a lot of the writing that I do that has extended from that, and certainly the the opportunities it's provided in these public arenas like NPR and various university classrooms and podcasts, is this chance to really talk to people and challenge that narrative and show them that, hey, you know, we are thinking, loving, feeling human beings who would like nothing more than an opportunity to, you know, to live, to grow, to continue learning, and help the public understand that they are a part of that process. And if they were to potentially even invest more time and attention on the people in prison, there's a really good chance that a lot of people can be salvaged.
I'm very curious about the process for this book and how it all came together. Tessie, I know you received dozens of essays from your co-authors. How did you decide which stories to include?
I chose the stories that had the most heart. There's a really core element of just emotion and storytelling in each of the men's narratives. And so I picked the ones that I felt displayed that arc and that narration of where they came from and who they are now the best.
Lyle, I know there were some disagreements because it was a very collaborative process as the book came together. Talk about the process of working collaboratively with all the co-authors to put the book together.
Well, there are certainly some disagreements about the order of chapters, and I think it's healthy if everybody was always on the same page. You begin to wonder if there was maybe an issue or a problem with groupthink, but that was certainly not the case with us. We were able to work out those disagreements, though, and I really feel that Crimson Letters has been developed into the best book it can be.
I think this one of the disagreements really illustrates some of the heart that went into this book and the deep thinking that went into the process of the book, but also perhaps the goals. Because one of the disagreements I understand was about how the book should end, Lyle. And talk about that. But over, you know, sort of what was the issue about which essay should end the book?
I thought that the book needed to end with executions because that is how our lives are challenged here on death row. I believe that if it is a book about being on death row, that the last thing the readers needed to remember once we've taken them through the journey of our humanity is that we're here to be executed. And that's more than anything really stuck firmly with me, and I was determined to make that happen.
How did it end up, though? There was the disagreement then was over sort of whether it should be how the book should end and whether it should end on a note of perhaps despair or optimism. Is that right?
Yes, that was kind of a part of it. Because one of the things that the executions do is that they make you despair, and that they're not pleasant. They're not intended to be pleasant. There is no justice in killing people, period. And that's kind of why I felt the need to end there, because this isn't necessarily a hopeful place, but we can bring hope to that conversation. Ending the book with executions reminds readers that they're responsible for these executions, whether they are aware of it or not, whether they vote for it or not, and whether they believe it or not. And if they had any inkling of a movement and a change of their opinion as they read this book, then by ending with the executions, they're reminded, like, oh, wait, we were a part of this.
Tessie, I know that the co-authors all had to take deep dives to write these essays, and you realized at a certain point that you may not have gone as deeply as they did, and this process changed you as well. Talk about that a little.
Oh, the entire process of writing and publishing and even promoting this book for me has been a constant back and forth between this inner struggle, between fear and courage. I have had to dig really deep within myself and to confront fears like, what am I doing? Do I really want to be the face of the death penalty? Am I willing to face the pushback that I know I'm going to get from people for advocating for this particular population of people? What's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to our co-authors? Will the prison retaliate? These constant fears that at times have been so crippling that I've almost given up, even after the book was finished. And so for me, it's just been a journey between learning how to confront those fears and overcome them, and to try to find the courage day to day to keep going, which is still a struggle, but it's something that I'm learning.
You also learned a great deal about our penal system in this process. Tell us about your thoughts now and how they may have changed over the process of making this book.
So one thing that I thought going into prison, I believed that the people who were on death row were the worst of the worst as far as the crimes that they've committed. There's a lot of people are convicted of murder, but very few wind up on death row. But what I learned from actually researching the death penalty is that we do not put the worst of the worst crimes on death row, at least not consistently. There were even people who were students in my class who were not convicted of killing anyone. They had been an accomplice to a crime where their accomplice had killed someone. And in both cases, the actual person who committed murder did not get the death penalty, while the student in my class did. And so I saw these just incredible injustices that I had never thought of before, and realized that rather than being a very targeted, let's give the death penalty to the worst, the death penalty system is more like a lottery. You don't know who's going to wind up there.
Well, Lyle, this book gives us insight into the co-authors and their lives and the humanity of the people who put this book together. But I think as we're talking about here, it's also an insight into our penal system that people who haven't come in contact may easily shrug off and may easily ignore. This, when we read this book, we can't ignore our penal system. What are some of the lessons and the education about the penal system that you hope come through in reading this book?
My hope is that people begin to really question what the death penalty means to them and how it's applied, but not just that, exactly how it works, how it's maintained on the books, even as public opinion declines for the death penalty, how people are continually sentenced to death by specific district attorneys in specific counties and not consistently across the state. It is only a handful of prosecutors that seek the death penalty now, and it's only a handful of counties that maintain the most death sentences. Even as juries continue to return life without parole verdicts, prosecutors continue to seek the death penalty, not because they have to, not because a case requires it, but because they just choose to, and they think it makes them look tough. And I think readers should really question that, should really begin to delve into the understanding of why are we still doing this? Why are we still putting people on death row when we know the death penalty is racist, when we know the death penalty is dysfunctional, when we know the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment? And my hope is that as people read Crimson Letters and they read other writing from myself and the co-authors about the penal system, that they start putting those questions to the people that represent them and make these decisions.
My guests are Tessie Castillo, a journalist, a public speaker, and co-author of Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row, and Lyle May, another co-author for Crimson Letters. He's a prisoner at Central Prison in Raleigh. Lyle and Tessie, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.